Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 45, section 4, which is old single column, page 513. Okay, so We've got another section with a, you know, that's kind of a list. Remember how these first sections, as they're starting us off, introducing us to the local system level in the local universe, they've been doing that introduction in kind of bullet point fashion, and they took us through each of the transition worlds. They gave us a little bit about the system sovereign, and then a little bit about the assistance to the system sovereign, that previous section, the three there, the system government. And now we're ready for another very important group of beings in our local system that, as you'll see as we start reading, if you long-time readers all know this, you know, this group of beings has just been in play since Pentecost. So it's a lot more recent phenomenon than even quasi-recent individuals like Laniforge, who took over from Lucifer, you know, 200,000 years ago. We've got some very, you know, recent doings here that are related to our local system. So let's see. I think that's all we need to do. Just right up front, because it's right in the title. If it isn't obvious to you, when someone says 4 and 20 rather than 24, you know, and they put it in that order, they're obviously speaking in a more old-fashioned English way, right? And you'll see as we get in to this first quotation here that they're pulling it out of the King James Version, you know, and so that's why the Revelators are just, you know, it's such a classic passage in the Book of Revelation. And it's said that way, even though a modern translation will say 24. So many people, you know, remember that passage, you know, in that mode of 4 and 20. It's like some things you just kind of can't help yourself. You just have to say thee or thou, you know, because it makes it feel like it's more appropriate, that it is attuned to the history of our planet. And that's why I'm belaboring this. It's, remember that the Revelation is always being designed to be as evolutional as possible. You know, it's not an evolutionary construct. It didn't evolve into place over millions of years, but it is evolutional. It's synchronized with the evolutionary process that we've been going through for a long time. And and so they purposely do things like that so that you will find something that's familiar, you know, that feels comfortable to you right away. And you know, it provides a handle. You know, it's important to have those sorts of things that you can get a hold of right away easily. You feel quasi-comfortable. Because the more you get into the Revelation, the more you'll find things that, oh boy, I don't know, that's very challenging. I'm not sure what I think about that. You know, that troubles me a bit, whatnot. They're trying to make it as approachable for us as possible. And just simple things like, the old familiar 4 and 20. I feel comfortable here. I feel like they've acknowledged that there's some validity to what I have in my head. They're not just going in there, you know, with a machete and hacking through everything in my mind and, you know, and leaving me desolate. I've got something that feels comfortable that I can hold on to and begin with. And then slowly over time, as I get braver, as I get more courageous, you know, I can take on the more challenging things. All right, so let's see what they've got here for us.
Number four, the 4 and 20 counselors. At the center of the 7 angelic residential circles on Gerizim is located the headquarters of the Urantia Advisory Council, the 4 and 20 counselors. John the Revelator called them the 4 and 20 elders. And round about the throne were 4 and 20 seats, and upon the seats I saw 4 and 20 elders sitting, clothed in white raiment. The throne in the center of this group is the judgment seat of the presiding archangel, the throne of the resurrection roll call of mercy and justice for all Satania. This judgment seat has always been on Gerizim, but the 24 surrounding seats were placed in position no more than 1900 years ago, soon after Christ Michael was elevated to full sovereignty of Nebadon. These 4 and 20 counselors are his personal agents on Gerizim, and they have authority to represent the Master Son in all matters concerning the roll calls of Satania and in many other phases of schemes of mortal ascension on the isolated worlds of the system. They are designated agents for executing the special requests of Gabriel and the unusual mandates of Michael.
Okay. So now it starts with something that seems a little bit odd. And you know, partly it's because we haven't gotten to that part of the book yet. When they say, at the center of the 7 angelic residential circles on Gerizim, we'll be getting to the specifics of those angelic circles in the next paper. But something, if you're a longtime reader, you may remember this, right? That there's another section in the book that talks quite a bit about the 4 and 20 counselors. And you might remember where that is. It's up in paper 114. Paper 114, which is entitled Seraphic Planetary Government. Right? The Seraphic Planetary Government paper. Ah, 7 angelic residential circles. There's something, see, that's synchronized here. And they don't, you know, fully explain this. But you can see that they're trying to suggest something about how the angels have some sort of closeness to the 4 and 20 counselors that's not immediately apparent with everything else that you read about it. You know, statements about Gabriel and Michael and these sorts of things. So, you know, it's just kind of there for you to sort of file in the back of your mind and wonder exactly what's the significance of this closeness of association between the 4 and 20 counselors, which seem to be, like I was just saying, more directly related to stuff that the Sun Ministry, S-O-N Ministry, is doing. You know, and then you've got the angels that are directly tied to the Creative Mother Spirit. So it suggests some sort of a coordination between the Creator Son and the Creative Mother Spirit down at a lower level that they don't explain. But it probably foreshadows, you know, a greater synthesis in the future, you know, as things play together more and more and aren't so much kind of in their beginning stages like they are now. So just note that. Now, you know, so there it is. I mean, and literally, if you pull out the King James, you know, they haven't tweaked a single word. I mean, it's just verbatim, and round about the throne were, I mean, it's just, you know, that's exactly, you know, as it is in the King James Version. So they're just pulling out that classic one. And that passage, that's the beginning part of the fourth chapter of the book of Revelation. It's in that same passage that you've got the mention of the sea of glass. You know, remember, they just mentioned the sea of glass here in this paper a couple sections back. All right, so we're in that mode where the parts there in the Revelation of John that have to do with the local system are being pointed out. Remember when we touched on this before, back when they were talking about Salvington, you know, there's visions of Salvington and visions of Gerasim that are blurred together in that, along with, you know, stuff that is just been added by other authors and stuff. Remember, the book of John, book of Revelation is very muddled, but it's even muddled in terms of genuine visions and John's attempt to express them as best he could. You know, because he's seeing things that he has no, you know, way of, you know, really interpreting properly. But he's doing his best to try to describe it as, well, this is kind of like this kind of stone, you know, and whatnot. You know, this is like jasper or whatever. You know, he's doing his best. But he's got stuff muddled between Salvington and Gerasim together. But this is the stuff that actually is, the 4 and 20 councilors are on Gerasim. The 7 adjutant seats are on Salvington. And it's all blended together in this passage. And of course, both places have a sea of glass, so you know that can—that's even a way that they could get—he could get them blurred together in his mind, you know, because lots of places have seas of glass, lots of architectural worlds. Okay, so you've got that classic passage, and they're just going to play off of that for the name for this. I mean, who knows, you know, what they actually call this group on high. I mean, obviously, they're probably indicated by the number 24 in some way, but, you know, they call them apparently something that is on the order of counselors, you know. So they're just kind of giving us a name that synchronizes with what we've got. Again, see that evolutional thing, like I was saying. Now, the whole bit about the throne, you know, you're reading in the Bible and you're thinking, well, that's where God's sitting, you know. It's like, no, not quite. It's not even where the system sovereign is sitting. It's where the archangel of the resurrections sits. You know, that quote-unquote archangel of Michael as opposed to Michael the archangel. You know, that confusion. All right, so they put these, you know, 1900 years ago, well almost 2000 years ago now, they put these 24 seats around that. And that's curious, too. It's like, well, what does the archangel, the resurrection, have to do with the seraphim? Well, I mean, seraphim are involved, and they're the caretakers of the soul, and, you know, so, but you're left still, it's all these juxtapositions that they don't explain. Just know it. They just state these things and leave it for you to wonder about. So anyway, you've got the archangel resurrection throne, and these seats of, you know, they're sort of residential locations or whatever, working locations around them. After Christ Michael was elevated to the full sovereignty of Nebanon, Pentecost, of course, we're talking about Pentecost, when so many significant things happened. You know, they didn't happen at the dispensational resurrection, a lot of these significant things, on Resurrection Sunday. So many of these things happened on Pentecost. That's when all the rebels were taken off the planet. That's when this very exceptional planetary government was set up. That's when these exceptional things on Gerasim were set up, etc. You know, so it'll be exactly 2,000 years ago come 2030. You know, and it was almost exactly 1900, you know, in 1930 when they were writing this. See? All right, let's see. Okay, so the counselors are his personal agents on Gerasim, and they have authority to represent the Master Son in all matters concerning the roll calls of Satania and in many other phases of the scheme of mortal ascension on the isolated worlds of the system. Just pause for a second. I mean, that sentence, you know, you could just pass by it until you remind yourself of who we're talking about. We're talking about humans from this planet, and all they've done is ascend through the seven mansion worlds and become Gerasim citizens. That's as far as they've gone.
Well, maybe not.
Well, except for Machaventa, but he's an exception.
Well, but that's an interesting question, because you think John got there that quickly?
No. We'll talk about that in a second.
And
no, we'll talk.
Have they been called back?
No. We'll talk about that. They explain that. We'll talk about that in a second. The whole issue, for those of you in the webinar, if you can figure out what's going on there, this whole issue of exactly when do they get in place here. We'll get into those details in a minute. But just the point I was trying to make is, it's like, for instance, John the Baptist. That guy that's, wandering out in the desert and stuff 2,000 years ago and, didn't know anything about advanced physics or, the physics of spirit substance or whatnot. It's just John, right? And in short order, he's got this job where Michael is saying, I don't need to handle this stuff. You guys can handle this part of my job. God, remember, Michael is God. He's personalized deity. So, we talked about, the Ancients of Days as God handing you jobs when you finally get up to Yversa. But look at this. You've got these mortals. You've got people that got a little bit off track, like Adam and Eve. People that are pretty minimal when they were mortals, like Anagar. You've got these mortals that all they have to do is go up through the mansion worlds and get to Gerasim, and God is handing them jobs. So it reminds you that if you take a hold of your potential integrity, in fairly short order, you can be given very great responsibilities. Obviously, no one on high would give me a responsibility right now like this. I am completely ignorant and undeveloped to handling like this. But knowing that in just a short while, in terms of my universe career, they're going to foster me forward to the point where I could potentially take on such huge tasks like this. That's pretty cool to think about. When if you worry that, I wasn't born with very good genetics, I never could even do very well in school, I'm pretty lumpen, they work through those issues on the mansion worlds in pretty short order. And you come out the other end, a pretty significant phenomenon. So it's very reassuring. That we're not as broken as we think. Okay? Yep.
So, let's take Enoch, for instance, who fused while he was on the planet.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you're saying that you don't think that he probably could have gone past Jerusalem and been summoned back from somewhere in the constellation worlds to be able to do this job.
John is, okay. For those of you who remember, John is
still...
We'll get to those. Wait till we get to the names. Okay. We'll talk about those logistic issues. Okay. All right. So the other thing there is, that last sentence is kind of curious. So they are the designated agents for executing the special requests of Gabriel. Okay. Now, Gabriel has all kinds of, assistants and deputies and whatnot, remember. So all of the, normal sorts of things that Gabriel would say, do such and so. Okay, there's already people that are on the job with all that stuff. So it's just these very special things that there isn't already a group of beings that are dedicated to that particular task. They, the 420, are taking those special requests of Gabriel and the unusual mandates of Michael. What does unusual mean? Usually, Gabriel is handling everything. Right, Michael doesn't, in general, Michael is not involved in the details of running the universe. That's Gabriel's job. He's down in the trenches and dealing with all of the specifics. Michael's the big picture person, right? He's the, the basic pattern for the uniqueness of this local universe, but he's not down dealing with the details, except on unusual, occasions, he does say, "No, Gabriel, I want to handle this directly myself. And he now has these agents that he turns to, these not so long ago mortals, who he assigns this task to instead of Gabriel. So again, he just knows that instead of handing the job to Gabriel and Gabriel feeding it down the chain, he goes around Gabriel and his whole hierarchy and goes to these group of, you know, one-time mortals not that long ago on Gerasim and hands them the task. You know, and if it's something where he has to do that, it's not, I need someone to paint the barn red. Okay, it's not going to be some menial task. It's going to be something very significant. That in some way he feels these people can do a better job, a more appropriate job than Gabriel and his team. I just want you to think. I mean, you know, we can read all this stuff and our eyes just kind of glaze over, but you want to stop and think about how significant this is. What's going on here? And even the revelators, remember, don't totally understand how it is that some very high things have been brought down and are put in the hands down low. Things that are normally on Salvington are now on Gerasim. Things that are normally on Salvington are on this planet, like the Archangel Divisional Headquarters. And assignments like this are being handed down instead of, you know, being delegated out up on high. So there's this whole first shall be last shall be first thing going on, where, you know, the normal kind of simple linear hierarchy has melted away, and it's beginning to function more holistically. Where, what's the difference between the bottom and the top? The top is the bottom is the top. Right? It's shades of where the whole grand universe is going. You know, when the grand universe is settled in light and life, when you have the full manifestation of the wholeness, of supremacy, you've transcended that whole linear kind of hierarchy. And it all functions as one system. Michael is doing this. He's jumping way ahead in some cases and instituting things that normally wouldn't get instituted until way down the road. Just like the way he skipped over the magisterial sun and jumped in and did a bestowal mission on this planet before we had a magisterial mission. And that's why, you know, there's no one can predict what's going to go on here. When they have this special college, the Melchizedeks have this special college to try to deal with, you know, the fact that you had the seventh bestowal in this constellation. One of the things that they're trying to be prepared for is what they can't predict. And normally, there's a lot of things that they can put off until way down the road before they have to have anything in place just in case, right? Now they don't know what, I mean, they got to be preparing for things that normally they wouldn't prepare for trillions of years. It's like, who knows? Michael may decide to do that tomorrow. And we've got to have the whole infrastructure in place so that if he says go, we can go. So it's a huge thing. Remember, they tell you that they all were just going, oh my gosh, and the Melchizedeks are scrambling. It's like, we're going to have to create a whole new college. This is like huge. I mean, we're going to have millions of teachers that are trying to deal with all the what ifs of what might happen here. Okay, that's what's going on. Okay, a lot more than just what meets the eye, and you just read the words, you know, in the paragraph. Okay, so now let's get into the meat of it here. You've got this group of beings, and they're going to go through them one at a time. And I'll address some of these questions kind of right up front, and we'll work through it. There's all kinds of little mysteries to this.
These 24 counselors have been recruited from the 8 Urantia races. And the last of this group were assembled at the time of the resurrection roll call of Michael, 1900 years ago. This Urantia Advisory Council is made up of the following members. 1. Onagar, the mastermind of the pre-planetary Prince Age, who directed his fellows in the worship of the Breath Giver.
Okay, so notice the 8 Urantia races. So they're they're not including the Noddite race. It's going to be our special Andonite race, the six Sangiks, and then of course the consequences of the Adamic uplift. When they say the last of this group was assembled at the time of the resurrection, I mean, for instance, you've got John the Baptist, you know, from that previous dispensation being resurrected. I mean, there was no point in doing a special resurrection for him, you know, a couple days earlier, you know. I'm sure they just waited for the dispensational resurrection because he just died not that long ago, remember. But he's...
get there so fast.
Okay, but we haven't gotten there. Okay, right. most likely, I mean, obviously I don't know this for sure, but most likely probably it's just exactly like they say, the time of the resurrection roll call. You know, so on Resurrection Sunday, remember they did the dispensational resurrection later that day. The last ones would have been there. Anyone that had died, you know, between Adam and Eve and you know, Jesus being resurrected, not Pentecost, okay. Resurrection Sunday, okay, is the dispensational resurrection, and Pentecost is later. So anyone who died, you know, prior to that, who hadn't already been resurrected in a millennial or a special resurrection, remember Moses was resurrected in a special resurrection, there's some exceptions. Okay, you're all getting resurrected. And so this whole issue of the logistics, they tell you that all of these individuals, except Machiavent and Melchizedek, was resurrected on the first mansion world and went through the seven mansion worlds and became a Gerasim citizen. Okay? And you're not going to do that, in a couple weeks, okay? So first of all, you're thinking, okay, what about the ones that were just resurrected, not too long before Jesus is setting this up? You don't have all of the permanent members on there immediately, any more than you have all 24 as permanent members right now. As soon as they get to Gerasim, they're made a permanent member. Now, you could speculate. Jesus said that John was a very great individual, the greatest really of that dispensation prior to him. Coming, that he might have stepped through fairly quickly, but up in that other section, up there in the Seraphic Planetary Government, they explain precisely that they all. None of them skipped the normal process. So, if it took him quite a while to get there, I mean, if it took him a few hundred years or something to get there, that's okay. He doesn't have to be immediately on the job. He's there now, after 1900 years, as this is written, and serves as the Hanavard over here, who was the chairman of that thing. John the Baptist serves as that chairman when they get together. So that was that doesn't have to be in place immediately. And then the other ones, like say Anagar that we already read. Okay, Anagar died almost a million years ago. Okay. That obviously gives him plenty of time to get to, you would think, to get to Gerasim. He was a pretty primitive individual, but did he go on up to the constellation level or even higher and then they pulled him back or what? No, they explain that just like Andon and Fanta weren't allowed to continue up, were kept at the local system level, these others are kept. For until the 420 counselors, every world has a group on Gerasim that is sort of the touchstone for that world, for the Gerasim government. if they want to kind of relate to that world, they've got this group of people from that world that they work through. Like they mentioned Adam and Eve. When they went up, when they got to Gerizim, the 420 counselors wasn't there yet, you know, but they were held there and worked on this with this group that are facilitating the coordination of the system government with Urantia. They say that directly. See, so you just you put between the lines, you know, okay, this is the way they've all worked between ever since Andan and Fanta all the way up to Adam and Eve, and you have those two definitely stated. The ones that have this job to do here are kept here. They're exempted from the ascension career for the time being. And you see they'll literally say that. So you know they weren't continuing to ascend and then brought back down. They're exempted from the ascension career for the time being. They ascend up to Gerizim citizenship. They've been working as agents for Urantia. And then finally, almost 2,000 years ago, Michael took some of them and put them in the 420 counselors. So that's the logistics of how it was put together.
So there could have been others of their contemporaries that have moved on.
Yeah, yeah.
Even like 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, and when we get to 1, 2, 3, the first, we'll speak to the specifics of that. Okay, but for those who aren't familiar with, they're going to refer to all these different beings that are talked about once you get up to the evolution of humans on the planet and getting the initial pre-blended race, you could call them, that race before the Sangiks, out of which you produced the six colored races. So you can kind of think of it's like the six colored races are all blended together inside of the Andanites, those immediate descendants of Andan and Fanta. Prior to the Planetary Prince, I think it was 10,000 years after Andan and Fanta, if I'm remembering correctly, there was this very exemplary Andanite individual that sprung up named Onagar. And that was probably basically his name in the Andanite tongue back then. That's probably not a coined name. They're probably just giving you a transliteration, phonetically it's his name. Okay? And he was the most exemplary individual. There were other great religious leaders or other kinds of leaders, but they explain these are just the ones that impacted the whole planet of that race, not just a localized impact. Yep.
Seems to me like the female point of view is grossly missing.
That's one of the interesting things about the default, and we're going to see that Eve is on this, how it brings that in, and Michael made sure that came in.
Yeah, but 1 to 16 so far?
Well, we don't know about, the eight.
I know.
See, could be females, right, some of them. But let's talk about that. Okay, so remember, none of these are males and females. Onagar, as a Gerizim citizen, is not a male. He's a Marantia creature. We're going to read that very shortly here in this paper. All of us are going to leave behind being males and females on the when we're resurrected in the first mansion world. None of us are going to be males and females anymore. We are one-time males and females. None of us will have a male or a female perspective anymore. We will have a Marantia perspective. We'll have a Moda consciousness. Moda consciousness is neither male or female. Why is Moda consciousness neither male or female? Because Moda consciousness is more definitively your personality manifesting as a holistic high self. And personalities are not male or female. There's just one flavor of personality. It's personality is transcendent of male and female. The fact that they were one-time males, this is still telling you something. I mean, it's not that males and females are disconnected from the facts on high. There are sons on high, like a Melchizedek is a son, not a daughter. Or a Lananadek is a son, not a daughter. And a Seraphim is a daughter, not a son. There are beings on high that serve more in the ministry of direction and those are called sons. And there's beings on high that serve more in the ministry of place, making sure that the beings have a place to be growing. You know, the seraphim are the cultivators of the domain so that you have a place to grow in. They make sure that everything is coordinated, that you have the appropriate environment that cultivates you towards your destiny. They're the place ministers. They function on a horizontal level. See, they function as a minister of place at a given level. Then there's other beings that minister along the vertical line. The quote-unquote sons, the ones that are ministering more to the direction, making sure that while you're being ministered in place and have a place to be and grow here, that when you grow, you have a place to go into, that you don't hit your head against the ceiling, that there's an opening ahead of you. You know, so they're ministering to make sure that there's no blockages in the vertical flow, just like those others make sure there's no blockages in the horizontal harmonization, that everything can harmonize together on a level. Some people minister like that, and they use our male-female pronouns to suggest that difference. But, you know, seraphim are not females. None of them have a female perspective. You know, and no Brilliant Evening Star or, you know, Lananadec has a male perspective. You know, they have Lananadec perspective or seraphim perspective or something. I mean, you know, the only place that you have male and female perspective on high is in the material sons and daughters. And that's it. I mean, that's where the male-female perspective is in them. But all these non-material beings can't have a male-female perspective. And so remember that, you know, don't anthropomorphize. You know, don't take our natures up. Try to recognize that there's a truth on high, and we're shadows of that down here as male-female. Male and female is a two-dimensional shadow of some more holistic thing on high. You're not going to want to have a female or a male perspective on high. I mean, you should already kind of get that sense here. I mean, if I think about myself as a male, I have a number of blind spots. Okay? I'm not very holistic. It'd be really nice if I could begin to transcend and be a little more three-dimensional instead of this two-dimensional shadow of something greater on high than I am right now. I don't want to have the perspective I have right now. I'm trying really hard to not have any interest in the opinions of Chris Halverson right now. I want to think like the Revelators. I want to have a mind that thinks like these celestial authors. I could care less about Chris's perspective, right? Because I know it's completely immature and childish and ignorant. Okay.
Isn't there a teaching that we do maintain male and female?
Okay, right, so that issue. Is it when I say you're not going to be male or female on high, the question is, what about, you know, when they tell you that when you go up, you maintain this relationship? Okay, I have an experiential nature that I embody that goes on high. What I am on high that's not going to be male has a male mortal origin nature that's built upon. I can always hearken back to, and even more objectively, obviously, on high, to what a male thinks like down on an inhabited world. I'll be able to look back at that and see through those eyes. So I'm a phenaliter, like the phenaliters are on this planet. The phenaliters are on this planet that used to be males when they were, you know, on a mortal world, you know, 6 trillion years ago or something. They help to... those that are ministering to understand the perspective of the males on this planet. And the finaliters that used to be females can help the celestials on this planet to appreciate the perspective of the females on the planet. Because they can hearken back to that. And remember, they can still see you. So when if a finaliter is standing in this room and he sees me, he not only sees my body, but he remembers how I see, because if he's a male, he remembers how he saw in that limited way one time, and he can appreciate my blind spots, you know? And he might even be doing things that might help have a situation where I could leveraged out of my limitations a little bit. I could begin to have a catalyst to see things a little bit the way Barbara does. I'm never going to fully see it, but because they know me so well, they could try to help me to know what I'm missing. Because that's my problem. I can't know what I don't know. I can't see what I can't see. You know, nothing can change the fact that I'm male. I can never see like a female. Remember how they tell you in the marriage and family papers? I mean, males and females, it doesn't matter if you're in the seventh stage of light and life, they still can't understand each other. Because they just can't, they can't see the same thing. You know, you can see all of the lower spirit beings and stuff, and you still can't see the same as each other. Right? So this is what we're trying to understand.
Yep. Yeah, I think her point was more that it doesn't appear, though it doesn't necessarily say it, yeah, male or female, that yeah, they were all one-time male. I mean, that was more her point. You know, were there any of these that were one-time female?
Right.
And, you know, some of them were, it doesn't say whether they're male or female. I mean, you really don't know, I guess.
Well, these, are, you know, these, they were males. I mean,
I think that was her point.
And I forgot. I got lost a little bit. Thank you for reminding me. Getting back to that. The point is that there are suns on high, and when you downstep that, the male is a shadow of a sun on high. The male is direction and the female's place. Two-dimensionally, but they are. And like I was pointing out, I mean, they're executing the special request of Gabriel. They used a male name for that being. And the unusual mandates of Michael. They used a male, you know, those are both sons. They're both beings that are dealing with the direction thing, not the place thing. So that's why it's not surprising that a lot of these beings were one-time males. That's what this group is about. But that's another reason why I try to point out they aren't the whole picture. Don't look for the balanced picture in this group. At the center of the seven angelic residential circles on Gerizim, and angels are she's. See, this whole conversation brought us back around. Oh, I'm starting to understand why they're in such intimate relationship with those she's. Because that's the quote-unquote female perspective. They're not supposed to be complete in and of themselves. This is a great lesson. I mean, remember, you know, I'm a finaliter and I'm perfected, but I'm inadequate. There's this job that I have to do, but perfected beings can't do that job. Only perfect beings can do that job. And so I've got to find a partner that's a perfect being, like a Havona native. And the two of us have to go out. And if we don't have the perfect perspective and the perfected perspective, we can't do the job. See, we've really answered it here. Yep.
So this is a crazy question. Yep. What about the hermaphrodites on this planet?
We'll actually get to that in a little bit. Amazingly so.
On this planet, but maybe particularly, we really need to let go of our stereotypes of men and women, male and female. I think it's something completely different there. It's something completely different, and we're
exactly
so hooked on our animosities toward the opposite.
Yeah.
It's really
Exactly. Yeah.
To get a handle on this idea.
Exactly. Yeah, and I'm challenged myself to try to understand that. I can say the words. I obviously don't really know what they mean, but I know in some way we don't have these issues on high. We overcome this tension that's just unresolvable here. And the truth of me as a one-time male and the truth of you as a one-time female can finally shine forth, and we will see how that truth fits into the cosmic system. And that's what I was just kind of getting at. They're trying to indicate that the truth of Anagar has a place, but only if it's right next to the truth of the she's, the seraphim. neither truth can really play out unless there's this coordination of that differential. You know, and the differential that we have here that we find almost impossible to coordinate because of the genetic facts that see, don't really allow it. We don't serve two masters on high. That one master that we slough off is the one that keeps us from having truth synchronized with truth and really working together as a coordinate pair. We'll leave that behind, you know, and we'll begin to shine. We'll know the truth, we'll be the truth, and we'll be set free from that other master that gets in the way of us synchronizing and delighting in our differences like we can't discover right now.
Yeah. I was just wondering about this all the mortal males and one female. There's been four epical revelations of the Father. This is the first one with the mother.
Yeah.
Women have been, in the Jewish, around Jesus' time, they had to sit in the back. haven't even been educated in one of the most educated countries. Mm. Until what, 100 and some odd years ago, or maybe a little bit more than that, not very much. And females haven't. But on a more bigger perspective,
right,
it's been the Father's picture, and men have been dominant.
Right, and that's why, like Jeanette was just saying, we have to try to overcome all of that historical baggage. You know, and not see this as some sort of a biased group, you know. Okay, let's...
Maybe it'll be more female now that the mother's
revealed. Again, I don't know. We can only speculate. But let's look at some of these individuals and notice some of the specifics. So you've got Anagar, almost 1 million years ago, pre-planetary Prince Andonite. And they give you a little tidbit with each of them. So notice what he taught about God, the breath giver. Okay, so you're at a very primitive stage. You can't contemplate really going forward, you know, beyond death and all this stuff very much yet. But you recognize there's something profound and sacred about your existence, about the fact that you're alive. And you want to honor that. So you lift that up and use it as the name for God. I have breath, and I remember in ancient times they thought breath was the life animation. You know, that was their notion of what made you living. You know, and so I have breath. There must be a breath giver. It's just focus on life. Okay, the giver of life. Okay, so look what happens when you go to the next one.
2. Monsant, the great teacher of the post-planetary prince age on Urantia, who pointed his fellows to the veneration of the great light.
Okay. Now, Monsant, post-planetary prince, he's also an Andonite. Okay. So you have the Andonites before the planetary prince and the Andonites after the planetary prince. Reminding you that a dispensation isn't just now they use yellow legal pad instead of green paper in keeping their records, you know, or something. Okay, it changes everything. Okay, the whole system of energy takes on a different flavor in a new dispensation. You know, the laws of the energy system are modified. Andonites were different in the dispensation of the post-planetary prince. And in that new type of Andonite, an exemplary individual sprung up, Monsant. And he embodied that consciousness of human. And what did he do? The great light. Okay. If any of you are coming from a Christian tradition, when you see great light, that should remind you of something. You remember how Jesus has talked about how they hearken back, it's Matthew, isn't it? Harkens back to Isaiah, you know, that a great light has come forth in the darkness. Okay, what is that great light about? It's the light of what that's shining in the darkness? It's the light of salvation. Okay, see how you've got light and life with these two. Okay, the first one, they can't really contemplate the whole salvation thing. But they can, you know, I'm alive and this is cool. Okay, so life. But you get this uplift from the new dispensation, and now they begin to contemplate salvation. They begin to look beyond now to the future. And God is now not the God of the present, but the God of the future. Very positive development. Yep.
What's significant about this for us now is that there are still people here who worship life.
Just life.
Just right. Life.
Are looking still down at their feet rather than to the horizon of their destiny. You know? And Jesus tried to say, I come to tip your chin up. I come to get you to look towards the horizon. Don't focus so much on the present. It's a fleeting moment with all of its vicissitudes. Set your eyes to the future, okay? Hold on tight to that. And if you do, you can get through these life difficulties much better. You'll begin to eternalize your consciousness. The little cork bobbing in the ocean will begin to stretch out into a big, heavy plank, a big beam for a large ship. Right, that can weather the ocean waves, right, and you'll begin to stabilize, and you can ride over some of the vicissitudes of the moment. See, and it happened long ago that humans began to know that. So how sad is it to record that there are beings alive today that are still back in the Anagar mode, where all they can think about and all they really worship is their life rather than their future. So that's the contrast there. And they don't tell you, but as you'll see as we go forward a little bit, most likely Mansant would have been pre-rebellion, pre-200,000 years ago, would be my guess. And I'll show you why in a second. So you've got someone, you know, who came to the fore when things were going well still, you know, with the planetary prince and his staff. And he was manifesting the fruits of the prince and his staff amongst the Andonites. They're awakened to a higher recognition. You know, if nothing else, being taught about the system sovereign, you know, as basically your first concept of God, gets you to lift your head up and not just think about what's going on here, but you think, well, there's something up on high, and I'm going to this place where God is, and right where the great light is. Because in the first dispensation, remember, they reveal God up to the local system level. And then Adam and Eve reveal up to the constellation level. You know, so you get the Most High, you know, as a name for God. You know, and you know, each dispensation takes it up a notch. Okay, so then we've got the next six are this, you know, each of the six Sangic races had a profound individual. And why don't you just read, you know, all the way through number eight, and then we'll talk about them together.
Number three, Anamanalantan, a far distant leader of the red man, and the one who directed this race from the worship of many gods to the veneration of the Great Spirit. 4. Orlandoff, a prince of the Blue Men, and their leader in the recognition of the divinity of the Supreme Chief. 5. Porshunta, the oracle of the extinct Orange Race, and the leader of this people in the worship of the Great Teacher. 6. Singlaintan, the first of the yellow men to teach and lead his people in the worship of one truth instead of many. Thousands of years ago, the yellow man knew of the one God. 7. Phantad, the deliverer of the green men from darkness and their leader in the worship of the one source of life. 8. Orvanon, the enlightener of the indigo races and their leader in the one-time service of the God of gods.
Now, I won't go into it here because it's a very extended discussion, but each of these names that they've selected for God, if you go in the library on the Perfecting Horizons website, in the Q&A section, there is one of the Q&As is about Sanghix and mind. And one of the things I do in that kind of extended Q&A to help you to understand the difference between the adjutants is, you know, to talk about how each of these 6 Sanghic races, you know, they all have all 7 adjutants, they're humans, but each of the 6 Sanghic races favors one of the first 6 adjutants. And that favoritism of one adjutant, not surprisingly, is going to have a lot to do with what part of the whole of God they focus on first and use as the name for God. And so I go through that little exercise of helping you to see how which adjutant they favor leads to why they chose these names for God. And it's a fun little exercise. So that's something you can do for kind of homework or whatever on your own.
Give us one of them.
Just take the first one. A red man favors the 6th adjutant, right? Spirit of worship, right? You know, remember you got the adjutants, our individuality, associativity, unity, 1, 2, 3, and then individuality, associativity, unity again, 4, 5, 6. The 6th adjutant is the long-term unity-like adjutant. That up front in their minds is unity. Spirit substance is the unity substance. What are they going to call God? The only thing they can imagine calling God. They're going to call God the Great Spirit. Right? Simple. That one's very, very straightforward. You just go through them one at a time like that. When you think about the nature of the adjutants, and you can pull them apart. Okay, so So besides that, there's some other things that strike you. Okay, the first thing you're thinking is like, well, okay, is this going to be red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet? Well, not violet. Skip violet for the moment. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo. Violet race, they come to upstep your relationship with the 7th adjutant. Right? That's the point. So that you can have homo sapiens sapiens, that wisdom emphasis from the spirit of wisdom. Okay? But, you know, and you go, well, almost. I almost have red, orange, yellow, green. Yeah. But blue is not in its spot between, you know, it should be between Phantad and Orvanon, and instead it's right after Onomatalantan, Blue Man. So you're going, well, what is up with this? Why is Orlandoff 2nd? It looks like they were wanting to list them in the red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo order. They don't explain. They leave you to just ponder this. But you notice it's almost that order, so it's like, well, okay, if there's some sort of a ranking in this order, you know that there's a descending nature as you go from red to indigo, and it wouldn't be surprising if a red man, you know, was ranked first, you know, and etc. In terms of their rank in these 4 and 20 counselors. But for some reason, blue is 2nd. Okay. My suspicion is, I don't know for sure, but my suspicion is the special thing that Orlandoff did which was kind of Eleonora-like. You remember Eleonora? You've got 37 rebellion worlds, and on Panopsia, Eleonora was this human that stepped forward and took the reins of the planetary government in the midst of the calamity. Orlandoff, merely 500 years after the rebellion, so things are still a complete catastrophe on the planet. Just 500 years after the rebellion, Orlandoff stepped forward and brought things back into order to a high degree with the Blue Man. I'm thinking that that's the key. That they're all exemplary amongst their race, but that was like exemplary beyond the race, sort of. I mean, to be able to so quickly get on top of what the planetary prince and his staff were telling them, to recognize, no, you know, in Van and Amadon-like fashion, no, this is not proper. Because remember, all these poor Sangic races, they were like just completely, I will do anything you say, Prince's staff. I mean, if you say jump off a cliff, I'll jump off a cliff. That's the mode they're in. And for one of them, so quickly, to get clear, to get objective on this, to get above that, I'm guessing that put him ahead in rank. That he brought forward more than just what Blue Man can do on his own.
Wouldn't have to do with time, though, right?
Now, this is the other thing that you might think. It's like, well, okay, are they ranked by when they got there? Well, let's see if we can make any sense out of that. So, Anomanolantan was 65,000 years ago. Orlandoff was 200,000 years ago. Porshunta was 300,000 years ago. Singlangton was 100,000 years ago. Phantad was 350,000 years ago. And Orvanon, they don't tell you specifically, but it looks like apparently he was post-Adam and Eve. Okay, so apparently the most recent one, even more recent than Anomanolantan. So, you know, I mean, it's like, well, okay, they're probably going to ascend at different rates because the races are different, but I have a hard time figuring out how, you know, he got to Gerasim first, he got to Gerasim second. It doesn't seem to work very well. I see, so the fact that, except for Orlandoff, they're just in the normal order. You know, on a normal world, which race crosses the boundary from fancy animal to actual genuine human first? Red Man, right? Because he's highest in rank. He's the one that's the most progressive by nature. So, you know, on almost every world, the first true humans are Red Man, right?
The others don't even exist.
Right, and they may not even exist yet, or if they're there, you know. See, you'll have, I mean, you have Red Man prior to humans, see, and stuff. And a lot of times on a normal world, you've got the races before any of them are humans. They're animals with those colors, you know. And then one of those, you know, within that red stock, one of them crosses the human threshold, and the sixth and seventh adjutants engage them, and they get encircled in the Holy Spirit, and right. So. You know, they have a very definite differential between the races about how much potential they have just in and of themselves. You can see why it is that none of these are supposed to exist in and of themselves very long. And, you know, they're supposed to be blended together. The whole point is you want to have a favoritism for all seven adjutants. Mm-hmm. You want to have some Red Man in you, some Orange Man, some Yellow Man, some Blue Man, some Green Man. you know. And especially you'd like some violet, so you have a favoritism for the seventh adjutant. You want to have all those so you aren't biased. You want to be symmetric. They're supposed to be blended together. And the very fact that there seems to be, you know, one is better than the other, you know, it's like, well, yeah, in that pre-blended state, Red Man is always going to cross the finish line first. You know, he's the hare and the others are tortoises. It's never going to be any different, basically. You know, they're just made that way.
But they all bring something to the table.
They all bring something to the table. You know, indigo man has something that no red man can have because he has a better relationship with the first adjutant than any of the others can have. And the first adjutant is very important. It's foundational. I mean, think about that. If you don't have a solid relationship to the first adjutant and I start building on top of that, I'm building on sand. That's not a good thing. See, you know, so they're very important. But together, none of them are complete in themselves. They're very inadequate in themselves. You know, and each of them, you know, when they talk about them, they had a really big blind spot. You know, there was always, and they favored just one adjutant over the others like that. That always leads to some big problem, you know, where they're really prone to being exterminated by another race or something like this. It's, they've got a big blind spot when they don't, aren't balanced. Okay, so that's the best I can do right now. I think they're ordered by the basic Sangic rank, and then Orlandoff, you know, has this little extra oomph that he manifested in kind of Eleonora fashion, and you know, and so he's given a rank right after Anamanalantan. All right, let's see. Maybe just one other thing to note. Yeah, we won't go through all of them, but notice how they vary the words some. You know, it'll say a prince, you know, and or an oracle, and notice, you know, for the orange man, the great teacher, and they call that individual an oracle. See how they're paired up, right? I mean, you know, they looked to poor Shunta to be the voice of the great teacher on high, you know, to be the voice of God. Even, you know, see, it's because they're thinking of that God as a teacher, something that's trying to come down and out rather than something that you're heading towards. You know, you're heading towards the great light, you know. That person wouldn't be inclined to be called an oracle because you're not thinking of something coming down. It's something you're going towards. So they try to pick names, see, that indicate that difference of perspective.
Now that you mention that, yep. They give Orlandoff prince, yeah. Like planetary prince, sort of.
Yeah, and prince also in its root word, you know, the root meaning is like principal,
yeah.
Chief. The supreme chief is the name. Okay. Now prince is underneath, you know, but the fact that you use it planetary prince, see, is not like under planetary king. No, you're using prince in the more root way like they're doing here, where he's, you know, the principal one, you know, he's the top dog. You know, that's the root meaning of the word prince, like planetary prince, the planetary one, the planetary chief. Okay, you know, you notice they threw in, you know, with Sing Langton, remember, they other spots when they talk about that whole bit about long ago, the yellow man knew of the one God. Remember, vague memories of Sing Langton and what he taught, feed forward, you know, you've got coming in prior to, you know, Buddhism, Taoism, Confucianism stuff in China. You actually have a personal God idea that stems back to what Sing Langton taught, and of course, just him as a person exalted into a, you know, a godlike memory, as Shang Di. You know, there is that personal God idea rooted back, you know, in Yellow Man's, in, you know, the Sons of Han history. Yeah, so they're just little things they throw in. Okay. Yep. If you go to the Evolution and Races of Color, you know, they mention all those guys again, and, you know, and except for Orvanon, give, you know, when they were, you know, what's that paper, 65, I think that is. All right.
Number 9, Adam, the discredited but rehabilitated planetary father of Urantia, a material son of God, who was relegated to the likeness of mortal flesh, but who survived and was subsequently elevated to this position by the decree of Michael. 10, Eve, the mother of the violet race of Urantia, who suffered the penalty of default with her mate and was also rehabilitated with him and assigned to serve with this group of mortal survivors.
So like we were saying, you know, they're not material beings anymore. I mean, they when they, you know, when they say relegated to the likeness of mortal flesh, remember in a normal world where the Adam and Eve, you know, take us all the way, take the planet all the way into light and life and stuff, but eventually at some point they do leave, and they talk about them, that those, that material son and daughter are quote-unquote humanized, and then an adjuster can come to them, and you know, then they'll die a natural death then, and they'll be resurrected, and they'll, you know, begin their ascension career. You know, because they unplugged themselves by defaulting. Okay, they were humanized. You know, in that very rough, crude way. So they did get adjusters, so that when they died, they didn't just cease to exist. They had a soul. That soul was taken to the first mansion world, you know. And like I said, they do mention this directly, you know, that so they had a Marantia body built for them. That Marantia brain, that soul was put in that Marantia body, and they worked their way up the mansion worlds and finally became a Gerasim citizen. And like I said, they directly say that they stayed there working as you know, helpers for Urantia until almost 2,000 years ago, and Michael pointed to them and said, I want you as on the 420 counselors. You know, but that, you know, they throw that, but who survived? Right? I mean, it's when you don't have an adjuster naturally, like an Adam and Eve don't have. I mean, it's not a given, you know. It doesn't matter that there's these archetype material beings on Gerasim, and got dematerialized and rematerialized basically like they were on Gerasim. They're these exemplary examples of beings like us. They don't have an adjuster, you know. And if they do something like this, if they don't do something that gets them an adjuster, that's it, all right? Really? They'll just die.
They don't just pick up where they left off?
No, I mean, because they're just material beings. They don't have any Marantia nature. It's ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Can't they cash in their ticket?
No. There's nothing there. So, you know, that's why they say, but who survived? It's not a given, you know, that if they're in that mode, they're going to survive. They've got to get an adjuster now.
Even if they're spirit-fused? Different kind of beings.
Yeah, see, I mean, again, you know, they're not primitive, so they're not going to be eligible for that primitive spirit fusion sort of mode, see? That's the thing, you know, they're, you know, if you were actually a primitive human, you could possibly survive, you know, by getting a temporary adjuster and being a spirit fuser, but you still have to get an adjuster, of course, you know. But, you know, these are not primitive mortals. These are like the cream of the cream of mortals. Doesn't get any higher than this. And so, I mean, there's no, you know, fallback thing for them. I mean, they either get an adjuster that they will eventually fuse with, or that's it.
You know? So what happened with their adjusters? They didn't fuse.
Yes, yeah. So somewhere on the mansion worlds, they fused with their adjusters, just like we will. And they now are, you know, Marantia beings that are fused with their adjusters, serving on the 420 counselors.
So they lost their mother or their material son and daughter status.
Yeah, the moment that they defaulted, they were unplugged and they lost that nature. Right. They just became humans like us.
And the tree of life wasn't effective.
You know, I mean, they still had some plumbing in them, you know, from, you know, but you know, it was like your appendix, right? It wasn't doing much of anything anymore because they weren't plugged into the energy inputs from the master physical controllers anymore. It was, you know.
They can get in the core.
I mean, what was that?
They can get in the core.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, as any human, they can go up and become part of the mortal core of the finality. But for the time being, they're not going anywhere. You know, they're on the 420 counselors. Okay, now just the one other thing, because we talked about it so much up front. You know, remember that as material sons and daughters, in a more general sense, they're material sons. They're part of the sons of God in the local universe. You know, remember, both of them are made by just the Creator Son. Right. Their job as material sons and daughters, in a higher sense, is to be material sons, you know, and sometimes they just call them collectively the material sons, like Life Carrier sons and Lamanadec sons, and they're part of those descending local universe sons, because they're ministering to the direction. They're there to foster the vertical dimension of what's going on in the local universe. You know, they're not there to foster the horizontal part. I mean, you have a pair of them so that they can produce offspring on a planet as an Adam and Eve as biologic uplifters. Why? To uplift, right? To improve this relationship to the seventh adjutant, like when you're thinking of the hourglass analogy of your mind, you know, you've got the six adjutants in the lower domain, and in the neck is the seventh adjutant. What's the way up into the upper domain? Through your relationship with the seventh adjutant. If they come to foster that, they come to foster your vertical movement, see? That's the whole point. They're fosters of that vertical direction. So that's why they're called sons. Even if they're also called daughters, to remind you that they're literally male and female and, you know, and sexual and everything. You know, so the words son and daughter are doing double duty. You know, when you call them material son and daughter, that son is different than when you call them both material sons. You're using the word son in two different ways. See? One is in a specific way, and the other is in a general way. Material sons for both of them, that's a general use of the word son. Material son, material daughter, that's a specific use of the word son in a more male-female sense. You know, like I said, I mean, they're called Lenonidec sons. That's in that general way, not in a specific way. There is no specific way. There's no males and females with Lenonidec. Okay, so that's the way they're using the language. All right, so, you know, see, Eve here is really, you know, they're both ascending sons. Remember, they've fused now, so they're not just faith sons. While they were here, they're faith sons just like we are, but they've reached fusion. They're ascending sons. Both of them are ascending sons, just like we'll all be ascending sons. We're about this vertical direction right now. As finaliters, we're not called ascending sons anymore. Because we're not doing the vertical thing. We ascend to perfection, then we penetrate horizontally to completion. As finaliters, you're doing the horizontal thing, not the vertical thing. So
that's female.
And see, you go seeking God the Father, and you go out as a finaliter, God the Mother revealing. See, you're revealing that cultivation of the harmonization of the in the whole. Right? So that's the way they're using the language.
One thing about the material sons and daughters, once they get their adjusters here, they go on to the mansion worlds and all such and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Weekends they can head for Jerusalem and visit their relatives and the material sons and daughters estates and all such.
Right. Think about Adam and Eve.
We
see,
don't got no estates.
They get to the first mansion world, and when they get some time off, they can take their little vacation trip to Gerasim and visit their children that are still there.
Yeah, their basements, absolutely.
From when they were still material sons and daughters, you know. And think about that when they had to face their children on Gerasim and try to explain how they screwed up.
It was her fault.
Oh, boy. Yeah. I think they probably weren't doing the, you know, pointing at each other thing. Right. They were probably both very contrite, very humble.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, my children, to have embarrassed you like that. Can you imagine how embarrassed their kids were when mom and dad screwed up like that?
Don't know.
Okay. They got to go to the social that week.
Well, they were all here.
Right, all their kids they left on, you know, they had a huge number of kids, you know, on Gerasim when they became Adam and Eve and, you know, and left. All those kids.
Not the kids
from here. The kids on Gerasim that they left behind when they became Adam and Eve. They had to face them, you know.
You should read this description of Cana again, though. He was a pretty good-looking guy.
Oh, yeah. And there was this moonlight, and it was glistening off his pecs, and... But it's just a reminder, she's a female, just like you are, has the same emotions that you do. If anything, she's She's the archetype expression of you. You can't be as female as she is. You know, we're a little blurred. You know, I'm not as male as a material son, and you're not as female as a material daughter. They're the archetypes. There's like no overlap. They're pure male and female. So they so need each other. They so can't see each other's perspective. You know, if we're a parent and one of the male or female dies, you know, the other parent has a little ability to kind of pick up a little bit from the parent that died, but not an Adam and Eve. I mean, if one of them is lost, that's why Adam did what he did. It's hopeless. He can't make up for her absence. It doesn't matter if he's a Gerasim citizen, material son. He completely can't make up for her absence. It's hopeless. So it's like, okay. You know, we're either together or we're not. So we're either together in default or we're together, you know, in integrity. There's only two options. Because we can't function separately. I'm completely inadequate without you. I can't do it without you. Right? Now the next three. Let you read those.
11. Enoch, the first of the mortals of Urantia, to fuse with the thought adjuster during the mortal life in the flesh. 12. Moses, the emancipator of a remnant of the submerged violet race, and the instigator of the revival of the worship of the universal Father under the name of the God of Israel. 13. Elijah, a translated soul of brilliant spiritual achievement during the post-material sun age.
Okay, so you've got three. See, notice they're pointing out these are three, the kind of what you'd normally have, you know, that represent the consequences of the Adamic uplift. You know, Adam and Eve being in here is a special case. But you've got these three that have a significant amount of biologic uplift. And so did anyone fuse during their mortal life until you had a solid condensation of that biologic uplift? No. Did Orlandoff fuse or Anamanalantan? No. I mean, until you notice that significance, that Enoch, you know, post Adam and Eve, is the first one to actually fuse during the mortal life. So that's probably typical. You probably never get a fusion until it's post Adam and Eve on the world.
Hmm. Okay. Is this the Enoch who wrote the book of Enoch that Jesus liked so much? No,
because that the author of that book of Enoch was doing the humble thing like they did back in those days. It's like, I'm not going to put my name on this. I'm not worthy. I'm going to pick a famous person of old. He was referring to this Enoch, you know, and saying, you know, let him have the glory. He's worthy of it, not me. You know, all of them, you know, none of them ever put their names on it. So they always picked some famous person to say, this is the book of so-and-so. You know, they're called pseudepigrapha. You know, the author is not the actual author, is what that means. You know.
Isn't it curious that no pure line Nodites fuse?
Yeah, or pure line Adamites. Yeah. So let's think about that. What's the problem with them?
Randa.
They're biased. Okay. I mean, is Enoch a pure line Adamite or even an Andite? No, he's got enough blend. I mean, see, the fusion. We talked about this. I mean, fusion is a cosmic thing, not a spiritual thing. It takes a lot more than spiritual to even go up the psychic circles. You know, go up those cosmic levels. Let alone to fuse itself, you have to have some holistic nature. So Enoch would have been someone with an adequate blending with the jump starting of enough violet. See, another reason why pure line red men are not going to fuse, pure line blue men are not going to fuse. They're not symmetric. They're lopsided. To make progress, significant progress, I mean, none of those six probably made very much progress on their psychic circles at all during their mortal life. They're way too biased.
Yeah.
They definitively favor one adjutant over the other six. They're not going to make much progress in the psychic circles. You know, even someone who did a really cool thing like Orlandoff, you know, he probably died a fifth circler or something. Right? I mean, it's not likely he made very much progress, you know, because they're not symmetric. So Enoch is the first one that had enough symmetry and enough uplift to get to the point of fusion.
Yeah. I'm just curious. I thought it was pronounced Enoch. Why is it Enoch? Like there's an I in
it. You can pronounce it Enoch or Enoch, either way.
I just wondered if that was a biblical way to Enoch.
None of these things. Everyone just has. They just have. You know, people choose a way to pronounce these names. They're names. I mean, how do you pronounce names? I mean, who knows how he pronounced it?
There's an O, so I would say Enoch.
But a lot of people just say Enoch. You know, they just put a schwa E. You know, a lot of times vowels become schwa E's. You know, that's just the way we...
Just like Marantia. When people say Marantia.
That's the way we pronounce things. Okay. Just pronounce it the way it feels okay. Proper to you.
So basically, what you've just been saying is that as the more blended you become over time, the more opportunity there is for people. While they're still here. Consequently, that's the reason that, you know, it takes quite a while for that to really be starting to happen on a larger...
Yeah, right. I mean, normally, you know, after 25,000 years of an Adam and Eve working on a world, they've got the races all blended, you're going to start to have some people fusing and stuff during their mortal lifetime. But before that, you know, and that's probably about how long it was after that Enoch lived. You know, we don't know exactly when he lived. But, all right, let's see. And Elijah, of course, another one that fused. And we don't, those are the only two that, you know, we know. I mean, there were probably others between Enoch and Elijah. Maybe some after Elijah, we don't know. But, you know, as great as Moses was, I mean, it's like, you know, they talk, you know, go back and read about Moses. I mean, they run out of superlatives, right? He didn't fuse, right? So, you know, and that may have been because he was really great at the job that he needed to be, that leader. But that's probably because he was a lot lopsided that way. He probably wasn't rounded enough to get to the point of fusion. But it made him a really great, you know, guy to emancipate the slaves out of Egypt and take them through the desert and all that. You know, he could draw a straight line, you know, and drag people along that line like nobody's business, you know. And if people wanted to go off squirreling, what did he do? He executed them and they kept going down the line. You know? Right? Yeah, John had his hand up first. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, okay.
I was just going to ask if you could elaborate on submerged violent race.
That we got so little biologic uplift. So for the webinar, she was asking about the submerged violet race comment. We got so little violet race that in many ways it's not a dominant phenomenon, it's a recessive phenomenon. And so just every once in a while, you know, you kind of get the recessive thing and it bursts forward and you get an exemplary individual. That's what they mean by
that. That the Hebrews had a lot of violet in them.
Well, it's not that they had a lot.
More than anybody else?
No, I mean, the Nordics had the most violet.
The Swedes.
But, see, again, the Nordic peoples are, you know, are kind of biased, you know? They're mostly blue man, you know, with some violet thrown in. They've got a little bit of, they've got a little red and a little yellow, but, you know, it's not balanced with the blue. So they're a little lopsided and amped up, you know, and that's why, you know, they, about the only thing they can think of is, I see a horizon, I've got my battle axe and I'm going towards it. Yeah. It's like, well, okay, that's a little bit limited. There's other things too. Right? You know, you remember how they say what heroic fighters Blue Man was, and then you amp that up with some violet blood, and you're going to have a serious guy with a battle axe. Oh, yeah, John, you had something.
That thing you were talking about, you know, reminds me of the the time that Jesus was talking to Jonah, and I think it was Jonah said, well, you know, I was going to make a businessman out of him, and you decided you want to make him a blah, 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 you know, blah, 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 blah. And Jesus says, well, perhaps we'll make them all four, which in a way is sort of back to that whole idea of being well-rounded as opposed to being so, you know, specialized.
Yeah.
And which gives you maybe more opportunities to be able to, you know, understand or experience, as you were saying, that those various different adjunct aspects of your life.
Right. Right. Yeah, man, and remember, no matter how you start out, that's the whole point of going from a seventh circler to a third circler. It's getting that symmetric where you get all seven adjutants turned on and in balance and proportion. That gets you to a third circler. And then once you've got all the adjutants up and working as a third circler, now your job is to bring them together as one. That's going from third circler to first circler. That's the basic, you know, process there. Right. And, you know, everyone starts out with some sort of bias, and your job is to try to get yourself symmetric and get up to third circler. Yeah. Okay, let's see. Anything else there? I think we kind of covered that. All right, yeah. So let's do Machaventa here.
Number 14, Machaventa Melchizedek. The only son of this order to bestow himself upon the Urantia races. While still numbered as a Melchizedek, he has become forever a minister of the Most Highs, eternally assuming the assignment of service as a mortal ascender. Having sojourned on Urantia in the likeness of mortal flesh at Salem in the days of Abraham, this Melchizedek has laterly been proclaimed Vicegerent Planetary Prince of Urantia, with headquarters on Gerasim, and authority to act in behalf of Michael, who is actually the planetary prince of the world whereon he experienced his terminal bestowal in human form. Notwithstanding this, Urantia is still supervised by successive resident governors general, members of the 24 counselors.
Right. Yes, and again, they're hearkening to the Seraphic Planetary Government paper where you can read a lot of those details. And like I said, if you go and read a little bit more about Machaventa, they give you some more of the details here that he didn't go up through the mansion worlds, you know, and become a Gerasim citizen. He's the only exception to that. But you know, when they talk about eternally assuming the assignment of service as a mortal ascender, you know, remember, that's not because he's really a Melchizedek anymore. He had an adjuster when he was incarnated. You know, remember, it isn't just the Melchizedek where they morph themselves and have a material manifesting body like they can do. You know, he was literally incarnated, humanized. You know, not a modified Melchizedek in the way they can modify themselves. He was humanized and got an adjuster. He was incarnated. And that adjuster built a soul, and that soul is incorporated into his being now, right? I mean, he didn't fuse with his adjuster because he doesn't need a spirit body for that soul to fuse with. He already has a spirit body.
That was Jesus' adjuster too, right?
And that adjuster did a bunch of things and then came back and served as Jesus' adjuster, yeah. And again, you know, Jesus doesn't need a spirit body. He already has one for the soul to fuse to, right? You know, for us, the whole point is, I have to leave the local universe as a first stage spirit. I need a spirit body to do that with. That's what your adjuster is kind of for. You know, the sort of basement level, you know, reason why you have an adjuster. Is you got to have a spirit body to leave the local universe with. So, okay, so, and then the other little thing, the quote-unquote forever a minister of the Most High, you're going, well, I don't think there's anything in the Bible that says like that. I mean, they're paraphrasing. You remember how they have those forever, in the book of Hebrews when they're talking about Melchizedek, they're just playing off of those words. And So that's the, you know, so that's not like that other one where it's just that verbatim direct quote. There's, they're kind of quoting the truth out of Hebrews rather than the fact out of Hebrews. And that whole bit about, remember, he was made vicegerent planetary prince sometime at the beginning of the 20th century. You know, maybe it was in 1930. No, and it's not because of the revelation that he was. I mean, so you could speculate that it might be, you know, because there is a changing of the guard, you know, in 1930. That's when we changed resident governor general. But, you know, maybe it wasn't. I mean, you know, you can only speculate. But you do know it's sometime there, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century. You know,
they do mention some other thing that they expected him to come right in and take over, but sure. He hasn't done a thing.
Yeah, especially the Sapernaphim, the primary Sapernaphim that's the, you know, the chief of the Seraphim right now. You know, he's one of those celestials that's in that camp. You know, why not yesterday? You know. So he argues for, you know, any day, any hour. You know, he can't imagine why they don't just do the whole fiat thing and, you know, yesterday. But, you know, then they tell you, but there's other celestials that argue differently. And
so it was really just that short time ago.
Yeah. See, that's the amazing thing. I mean, literally, you know, it's probably, you know, the one other thing that, you know, I would think would have to be at the same time is when they rounded up Satan and interned him, I'm sure simultaneously he was made vicegerent planetary prince. Okay, those two are very likely simultaneous events. But whether or not that was 1930 or sometime before 1930, or I don't know.
Wasn't it Jesus who saw Satan falling?
Right, so, well, remember, but that's, yeah. Yeah, that...
He wasn't rounded up yet.
Yeah, that's a long tangent. Let's not go off on that tangent. Okay. Okay, let's then do the next one.
15, John the Baptist, the forerunner of Michael's mission on Urantia and, in the flesh, distant cousin of the Son of Man.
Distant cousin because everyone remembers, don't they?
Oh, Sarah. Elizabeth and Mary.
Elizabeth and Mary were kins, you know, of the same kin, of the same clan, sort of, yeah. And, you know, and we already basically said this up front, see, so, you know, he had to work his way through. We don't know how long it took him. It's less than 1900 years.
Yeah, I know.
Exactly. See, so that's an interesting data point, see, you know, if he's probably precocious, but, you know, it shows you can work your way through the mansion worlds without, you know, being there for a million years. You know, we don't know. Maybe he was precocious enough. He skipped the first mansion world and had to just do 2 through 7.
Nepotism didn't hurt. He was in with a bomb.
Nepotism. That's probably it. It's yeah, favoritism. It. I hear God is a respecter of persons.
Oh, well,
he knows him. No. See, that's another thing. You know, see, that can't be it. I mean, they didn't change the rules for him. You know, it's not like us where we graduate people from high school who can't read yet. They didn't do that on the Mansion Worlds. You know, okay? They need someone who can read on the 420 counselors so that, you know, I mean, if he doesn't embody what you get on those all seven of those Mansion Worlds, he couldn't be on the 420 counselors. Any more than I could be on the 420 counselors right now, right? You can't have a little kid working for, you know, in Michael's stead. You need a solid adult of God to take this job. Oh, yeah. So, all right, and then.
Do they mention back when they were talking about John the Baptist, if what he did was qualified as making a supreme decision?
They don't You know, they don't give you the specifics of like any of the apostles or John the Baptist having a gesture, but they obviously all did. You know, because they subsequently occasionally refer to the apostles having a gesture. I mean, you can just imagine. I mean,
but I meant, did they make the supreme decision where it would have gone to a
The most likely way, if they weren't reservists, okay. I mean, some of these they could have been reservists and they would have gotten an adjuster because of that. The most likely way is the same way that Cain, got his adjuster when it's pre-Pentecost, and that they would have made the supreme decision. Now, the other possibility is, I mean, Elizabeth, Zacharias, right? Isn't that his name?
Yeah.
They probably had adjusters. Because, they apparently were not, very primitive. So John the Baptist probably got an adjuster automatically at age 6 because his parents had an adjuster. Remember, when you're pre-Pentecost, there's an awful lot of people that are getting adjusters automatically at age 6 just because their parents have an adjuster. The only way those other things come into play, like, why does Cain have to make the supreme decision at age 20 in order to get an adjuster? Because his parents don't have an adjuster.
I was just thinking about how John became on went through and went on the 420. So if there's an indication that he made a supreme decision, he would have already been up.
Most likely, it's not that would get him through quicker. It's what Jesus says about him. No greater man has been born of woman. Okay, that's probably why he went through so fast. He was a precocious individual. He was putting things together quickly. Even though he died at a young age, he probably wasn't a seventh circler. He was probably starting to put some things together. And the rest of us are walling around in the dark here. Okay, the next one.
16. 1, 2, 3, the first. The leader of the loyal Midway creatures in the service of Gabriel at the time of the Caligastia betrayal, elevated to this position by Michael soon after his entrance upon unconditioned sovereignty.
Talking about Pentecost there. So at the same time that they took all of the rebel Midwayers and rebel angels off, at that planetary adjudication at Pentecost, they 1, 2, 3, the first, he's a primary Midwayer, remember, with that designation. The secondaries are ABC, the first, etc. All right, so he's the first of the primary Midwayers, remained loyal during the rebellion. And how does he get off the planet? How does it work with Midwayers when they're finally taken off the planet in a normal positive sense? They are described as being humanized in Morantia, or in Morantia form. So, like an Adam and Eve is going to be humanized in material form. They're going to get an adjuster. They're going to die a mortal death, and they go with a Midwayer. They are humanized in Morantia form. So they're humanized like you will be as if on the first mansion world and with a Morantia body.
So they can slip into a transport seraphim.
Right, so they could be transported by transport seraphim, see? So, but they're humanized in Morantia form. They get an adjuster. That being is transported to the first mansion world and he works his way through the seven mansion worlds as a Morantia being. So that fact that you can, when you humanize them like this, that they don't become a material human, but they become a Morantia, human, quote-unquote, an ascending mortal, that's because, that beginning Morantia substance is kind of parallel to the kind of energy that their body is made out of. You're just modifying that energy and expressing it as a Morantia thing parallel to it. And as a primary Midwayer, I'll bet you he skipped the first couple mansion worlds in a week, just spent a week, 10 days on it, some of those, because he's probably got some of that basic stuff already. So he probably went through the mansion worlds pretty quickly, too. Okay, so that's, and again, it's, you know, when you're talking, and they talk about light and life, they describe this humanizing thing. That's where you can find that that information. So that's how he would have gotten there. Okay, now what else do we have here?
These selected personalities are exempt from the ascension regime for the time being, on Gabriel's request, and we have no idea how long they may serve in this capacity.
See, and someone like John the Baptist is exempt just simply because of the 420 counselors. But someone like Onagar, or like Andon and Fonta, you know, are exempt too. I mean, Gabriel gave the order long, long time ago for them to not ascend beyond Gerizim and to hang around and, you know, and be point people for connecting the system government to their planet. So when we get to Gerizim, there's going to be a whole bunch of ascenders there whose ascension schemes have been arrested. And they're just hanging around, you know, for the time being on Gerizim, being, you know, helping to administer to their world that they came from. You know, and we don't know how many there are, but there's likely to be a bunch of them. Yeah?
The language they use, exempt from the ascension.
Right.
Is the ascension a condemnation?
Well,
that's taking it to the other extreme, but there's
the reason they say exempt like that is because of the literalness of why you ascend. Remember, you fundamentally, the reason you ascend is you've got a spirit fragment inside of you, and spirit gravity has a hold of that, and it just pulls it up. I mean, you're exempt from spirit gravity. I mean, this has to be communicated. Gabriel has to communicate to a personalized adjuster that communicates with that adjuster. I mean, there must be some switch that's turned off here, okay? I mean, so the spirit gravity is not pulling them up. I mean, that's why Adam and Eve don't have adjusters, because then they can't serve in that horizontal mode like they're supposed to serve for a while, right? You know, as permanent sort of, they'd be drug up, you know? So the easiest way to be exempt from spirit gravity is to have no spirit gravity pulling on you, right? But for someone who has an adjuster in them, something's got to be short-circuited or something. I mean, so that they're not being pulled up. And they don't explain that physics. I don't know how to think about that. But that's what so that's why they say it so legalistically like that, sort of, see? How could I be exempt from material gravity? Oh, there's master physical controllers that have anti-gravity. I mean, as we're sitting right here, we're exempt from some of the gravity of the sun because the master physical controllers are negating some of the centering influence of the sun. See, so right there you see, so maybe that's how they do it. Maybe it's not a switch. Maybe there's some sort of an imposition of anti-spirit gravity. Because remember, they don't reveal all of the spirit power beings. Maybe you've got some of those spirit power beings on Gerizim with an anti-spirit gravity presence that they can focus on individuals and keep them from being pulled up in the elevator. I don't know. Okay. So that's what's going on there. Okay, so now we've got the other eight.
Seats numbers 17, 18, 19, and 20 are not permanently occupied. They are temporarily filled with the unanimous unanimous consent of the 16 permanent members, being kept open for later assignment to ascending mortals from the present post-bestowal sun age on Urantia.
Okay, and you wonder, it's like, well, are the temporary ones there from the post-bestowal sun age? I mean, we don't know. You're going, well, okay, post-bestowal sun age. I mean, you know, we're thinking it. I mean, who knows? Maybe 200 years from now or even sooner, the magisterial sun will arrive or something. You know, so this might not be that long. So, you know, so maybe the 420 counselors in this way, they're not going to be exempt that far into the future. But then you read the next paragraph. All right?
Numbers 21, 22, 23, and 24 are likewise temporarily filled while being held in reserve for the great teachers of other and subsequent ages, which undoubtedly will follow the present age. Eras of the magisterial sons and teacher sons and the ages of light and life are to be anticipated on Urantia, regardless of unexpected visitations of divine sons, which may or may not occur.
Okay, we'll deal with that last sentence last. But the first part, Jared, just, you read that and you're going, well, that I wasn't expecting that. I mean, they have built in planning for teachers like Landoff, you know, and whatnot, for teachers, Trinity teachers on ages. I mean, that could be 100,000 years from now. And you're going, whoa. So this whole bit about, you know, it might not be that far in the future that Machaventa Melchizedek assumes planetary prince and pulls himself out of this, and they'll have to fill his spot in the 420 counselors. But, you know, your first thought is that, you know, he pulls himself out and the 420 counselors dissolve. I don't know. That doesn't seem like... So, I mean, you know, these beings might be exempt from the ascension scheme for a... Who knows, until we get to light and life or something. You know, and it's like, well, why would that be? Why would this thing that was started at Pentecost go so, you know, that seems to be, you know, they talk about it in the Seraphic Planetary Government where they're talking about all these special things that are only here because we don't have a planetary prince, and, you know, isn't this just temporary stuff? This sounds like it's long-term. Oh, yes, that's right. Michael changed everything. He's got Salvington stuff going on Gerasim and on Urantia. This is that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if these individuals are here all the way through light and life. I mean, that wouldn't be very odd for Adam and Eve. They were supposed to be on Urantia at least until the first stage of light and life, if not, you know, not even later than that. So these sorts of timescales are not atypical, you know. So think about your ascension scheme. You know, there may be something in the future where you take a long detour on a horizontal track for a long time and do a whole bunch of things, and then finally you get back to going up.
It's and when you nice see your job later on, it's not just here. Their job contains other planets as well.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing, you know, they don't tell you right in here is... Remember, they are, they're not 24, but they're varying numbers. There's commissions like this of counselors that work with the other 36 rebellion spheres, and this 24 oversee those other groups. And, I mean, not only do, you know, these take turns coming here as resident governor general, but they come here just as counselors, frequently, they tell you, and to the other rebellion worlds, frequently. So, I mean, you know, one of these guys is the resident governor general right now. You know, let's say it's Anamal Antan, okay? But, you know, Elijah might be here too, for all we know, you know, and doing whatever. I mean, you know, Machaventa was here not that long ago. He was here on the planet when we, you know, when he was serving as, you know, leading the commission for part four, you know? So, you know, they definitely are here, you know, frequently. Besides being resident governor general,
there is a piece in the that says on Monday mornings they all meet with the student visitors as well.
Right, you've got, you know, and you've got that whole bit of thinking about the planetary government, and that's why I always joke about, you know, when they tell you about the cosmic reservists, you know, and they're an open part of the planetary government, unlike the destiny reservists, and you know, so you've got the Monday meeting, you know, just like a lot of people have who work at a big company. You know, there's the Monday meeting for the week. I mean, you know, you got this guy who's a cosmic reservist. He pulls open his day timer and he sees a 10 o'clock meeting with the resident governor general. You know?
No wonder John's
ever in my mind. So, but, But yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, it's just, you know, it's that seemingly prosaic, you know. Okay, but then the other thing, you know, and we occasionally refer to this, and see here, you can easily speculate this when you start thinking about, okay, well, Michael turned everything on its head when he skipped the magisterial son, and of course, he came as a bestowal son with an asterisk. He couldn't really do the bestowal son, the spiritual uplifter thing, because he skipped the, you know, the mind uplifter, magisterial son. So that's why he said, I've got to come back, you know, because he's got to finish the actual spiritual uplifter thing sometime in the future when he can, when we actually are upliftable. We aren't upliftable right now, okay? We don't have the foundation underneath it. We don't even have the biologic uplift, for Pete's sake. How can we have the spiritual uplift, right? So he's got to come back. So everything, you know, it's a wild card world. And we remember how we often talk about this when they talk about how there are all kinds of unrevealed sons. See, here's the one spot where they directly, we're not the only ones speculating on it. Some of the celestials are doing it too. Regardless of unexpected visitations of divine sons, which may or may not occur. Right? Some celestials are thinking like we often do. I wouldn't be surprised if some unrevealed son shows up someday on this planet. You know, that has to do with the third scheme, you know, instead of the ascension scheme, you know. Because remember, that's what we're saying. I mean, Michael is, he's like making it so that there's things going on down here at the bottom that are supposed to be at the top. Well, if you take the top and put it down to the bottom, what does that do for the upward arrow? You know, of just ascension through the local universe. See, by doing that, he's bringing in some other scheme besides the ascension scheme. It's just right there, obvious. You know, does the arrow go this way or this way? Well, it probably doesn't go either way. It's something that doesn't have to do with the ascension scheme that he's instituting on Gerasim and on this planet. And there's got to be divine sons related to those other schemes. And so should we be surprised if one of those sons that isn't even revealed shows up someday? Maybe he comes before the magisterial son or before Michael, or maybe that's why Machaventa isn't assuming planetary prince, because there's this wild card being that's going to come first. I mean, that's what's the kind of crazy stuff that's going on this planet. That, you know, our great-grandchildren or something might get an unexpected visitation, quote-unquote, from some being they can't even read about in the Urantia book. And what that means, no one knows.
It's kind of nice that these persons are held up, because we don't have any history. A lot of history's been wiped out on the mansion worlds, and plus that gives us a chance to actually maybe meet them and get to know.
Yeah, and as we read through the more about the local system, you're going to have a lot of interaction. These 24 are bosses in a lot of ways. I mean, they're the final say in a number of things about you getting through the local system. You know, we'll touch upon those as we go along. You know, they're not just, you know, overseeing what's going on those worlds below them. I mean, they have a lot to do with you getting through. You know, if they put their thumb down, you've got work to do still on one of the mansion worlds. They, you know, they're gatekeepers of your ascension through the mansion worlds and stuff. So
many of these people have been instrumental in teaching the people or revealing. I wonder where the Saddlers might fit in.
Well, you know, we can start speculating about, you know, all sorts of great people that they don't mention. You know, that, you know, even think about that. If some really luminary figure that's died not that long ago, you suppose they got resurrected in a special resurrection? Because maybe it was decided they needed to be on the 420 counselors as a temporary member sooner rather than later. You know, see, that's one of the reasons why Moses was, you know, Moses and those and some of his cohorts, the powers that be decided they needed them in the mix with the other ascenders because they had something going on, and he was important to catalyze that, what was going on in the mansion world or something. And so they brought him up in a special resurrection.
She said Elvis.
Elvis is not dead. Yes, right. right. Just the one last thing.
John thought Gandhi, I thought
Oh, the contrasts. you know, just the one little last thing, and then we'll wrap it up. You know, as we gave you the 17 through 20, and you're wondering, you know, immediately, it's like, well, do you suppose those temporary ones are from the current dispensation? You know, and then they tell you that there's the other ones. It's like, well, obviously they aren't from subsequent dispensations, you know. So that feeds back, you know, and just because the four permanents are going to be from 17 through 20 are going to be from this dispensation, it obviously it doesn't mean that necessarily temporary ones. I mean, some of those temporaries might be someone that lived 500,000 years ago and he's still exempt from ascension on Gerasim and he's serving temporarily on the 420 counselors.
But they're all from here.
But yeah, I'm glad you mentioned. That's the last thing we should mention before we wrap up. It's way back when we were talking about the assigned sentinels. Do you remember about the associate inspectors and the assigned sentinels, those agents of the supreme executives that work down in the local universes? And the assigned sentinel at this local system, he's the ex officio head of the 420 counselors in that local system. Every local system has a 420 counselors with that assigned sentinel as the ex officio head. But normally, those 24 are from all the different worlds in the local system. You know, the oddball thing is, in our local system, they're all from this world. Because again, Michael has stepped in and he's bringing Michael things down into that mix, and he's using the 420 counselor mechanism as a means of implementing whatever he's got going on, where he's bringing Salvington down to Gerasim. He's taken over that normal mechanism.
We're becoming his Camp David.
Right? So, yeah, I thank you for doing that, because I even put a bookmark in here because I wanted to, you know, that's back in, what is that, Paper 24, The High Personalities of the Infinite Spirit, in Section 5, if you want to go back, that's where they mention that about the 420 counselors that are, you know, a normal part of the structure. So it's not a, you know, it's normal to have the 24, but it's not normal to have them all from the same world. Okay, all right, so next time, you see, we'll kind of shift gears. We're done with the kind of overview list thing, and the next time we'll get into these the remaining sections where they give us a little bit about what's going on Gerasim. And the first thing is the material suns, and there's all kinds of very cool stuff in there that quickly becomes very relevant to questions that we all have. When we get to section 6, you get that whole death and resurrection question thing in play, and so I'm sure we'll have lots of discussion about that. All right, let's take a moment here.